Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar series, where great professors teach you. My name is Richard Poe, and I'll be your host. Today we begin a course entitled A History of Moral Thought: What's Right, What's Wrong, and How We Know the Difference. Your professor is Peter Kraft of Boston College. Professor Kraft has authored over 40 books, including Philosophy 101, An Introduction to Philosophy, Back to Virtue, Traditional Moral Wisdom for Modern Moral Confusion, Summa of the Summa, The Essential Philosophical Passages of St. Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica, edited and explained for beginners, C.S. Lewis for the Third Millennium, Making Choices, Practical Wisdom for Everyday Moral Decisions, Socrates Meets Machiavelli, The Father of Philosophy Cross-Examines the Author of The Prince, and Socratic Logic, a logic text using Socratic method, Platonic questions, and Aristotelian principles. This course addresses some of the eternal questions that humans have grappled with since the beginning of time. What is good? What is bad? Why is justice important? Why is it better to be good and just rather than bad and unjust? Most human beings have the faculty to discern between right and wrong, good and bad behavior, and to make judgment over what is just and what is unjust. But why are ethics important to us? This course looks at our history as ethical beings. We'll travel into the very heart of mankind's greatest philosophical dilemmas, to the origins of our moral values and the problem of ethics. Are ethics universal, absolute, and unchanging? Or are they culturally relative, changing, and created by humans? Furthermore, we'll delve into the creation of ethical systems, not just for ourselves, but also for society at large. And we will consider the ongoing process of establishing ethical frameworks for society. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites, a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students, and yes, of course, a final exam. And now we begin A History of Moral Thought: What's Right, What's Wrong, and How We Know the Difference. Lecture 1. Being Good and Everything Else. An Introduction. And now, Professor Kraft.
Why are you listening to these lectures on the history of ethics? What do you think you're buying with the money you spent for them? And more important, the time you are now spending on them. Time is life. It's precious. You are investing a little bit of your lifetime here. What can I give you for it? And will it be what you wanted? I think you wanted to think. If you only wanted to be entertained, if you wanted someone else to tickle the suburbs of your brain for a little while to relieve the boredom, you would be listening to something else. And you want to be self-educated. If you thought that education was only what happens in school, you would be thinking, I'm out of school now, so education's over. And I think you want to philosophize. Ethics is part of philosophy. Philosophy means the love of wisdom. If you didn't love wisdom, you wouldn't want to philosophize. You can't study philosophy without philosophizing yourself. Philosophy happens between your ears, not between the covers of a book or on a CD player. Finally, you want wisdom about ethics, about that crucially central dimension of our lives that we call morality, or right and wrong. You could have chosen something easier and less important to think about. And you want to think about ethics in the company of the great philosophers of the past. You chose this series on the history of ethics. You want to think for yourself, but you don't want to think by yourself. You want to join the great conversation. If I have your mental profile right, welcome. I shall try to supply what you are looking for. Within these parameters, let's be more specific about the scope and purpose of these lectures. I want to focus on the big questions in ethics, not the little ones. When I try to remember what I learned at Calvin College and Yale University and Fordham University and the University of Pennsylvania, when I remember the half dozen really great teachers I've had, when I ask what I am grateful to them for I do not come up with hundreds of little ideas, but with just a few big ones. And when I turn my attention to the thousands of books I've read, I come up with the same result. A few great books are worth much more than thousands of little ones. I agree with William James, the American philosopher who divided philosophical questions into big ones and little ones, or as he called them, live issues and dead issues. Live issues are questions that make a difference in our life. Those are the big questions. Does life have a real objective meaning and goal and purpose and design? That's a big question. Are we basically good or evil? Are we free or determined? Is there a God? Is there a life after death? Those are all big questions, live issues, questions that make a big difference to our lives, to everything in our lives, and certainly to our reasons for being moral. Unfortunately, most ethics courses today do not have that focus. They're usually more like law school case studies. They usually do a good job in prodding you to think about how to apply principles to cases, but they don't usually explore the foundations for those principles. What they do seems very interesting at first, arguing about whether a given war was a just one, or whether cloning or abortion or surrogate motherhood or homosexual marriage should be allowed, or about the conflict of rights between developers and environmentalists, or between police and suspects. Well, that's a legitimate part of ethics, but I don't think it's the most important part, and in the end, not even the most interesting part, even though at the beginning it may seem to be. All those questions are examples of what we could call arguing forward, from principles to applications. The technical name for that in ethics is casuistry. That's a perfectly good and legitimate thing, although the word casuistry has acquired the misleading connotation of something dishonest or hypocritical, or at least inhumanely legalistic today. But I want to focus on the opposite mental process, which we could call arguing backward, exploring the foundations for our principles. We find surprisingly little disagreement about ethical principles. Almost no one defends injustice, cruelty, stupidity, slavery, murder, selfishness, cowardice, addiction, despair, hatred, or arbitrariness. And almost no one attacks justice, kindness, wisdom, freedom, respect for human life, peace, courage, self-control, hope, unselfish love, or reason. The disagreements come in two places. When we try to apply these principles or values to complex situations, that's casuistry, and when we try to ground them, or justify them, or explain them to explore their foundations. To do casuistry, to argue forward, you don't focus much on history, because you are looking forward, looking at the future. But to do the second thing, to think backwards, to explore the foundations of the ethical principles, we find the history of ethics is very helpful. To see that, make a little thought experiment with me. Suppose that a dozen of the wisest thinkers who have ever lived were alive today. Solomon, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, Descartes, Pascal, Kant, Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, Buddha. Wouldn't we want to listen to them and dialogue with them and insert them into our thought lives, into our conversation? Of course we would. Well, we can do just that. Or at least we can do it to their ghosts, because they wrote great books which give a kind of afterlife to their thoughts. We can insert them into our conversation by inserting ourselves into their conversation. They conversed with each other. They entered into dialogue with their dead predecessors, and we can all do that. Philosophy is not an elitist thing for Olympian gods. It's for all humanity. These great philosophers speak to us, and for us, or against us, and we have to respond. We have to talk back. We can't just be passive. They're not entertainers. They're thought prodders. Another reason for doing ethics by looking at its history is this. It's almost true that there is nothing new under the sun. We seem to be confronted with new ethical problems, both in theory and in practice. In practice, we see scandals at the highest levels of government, business, and church. In theory, we see new challenges that our ancestors never dreamed of, like genetic engineering and cloning, radically new attitudes toward sexuality and family, new responsibilities to the environment and animals, new forms of war, terrorism, and weapons of mass destruction. We seem to be living in a brave new world. But these ethical problems, both in theory and in practice, are not wholly new. In practice, there have always been scandals. We humans have a history of finding it very hard to practice our principles. And in theory, I don't think there can be wholly new principles, only new applications of old ones. Think what wholly new ethical principles would look like. Imagine a society dedicated to selfishness and cowardice and dishonesty and injustice as moral goods. It's literally not imaginable. We can imagine a personal preference for evil. We can desire hatred or rape or torture or murder, but we simply cannot experience a moral obligation to do those things as moral goods. In all of human history, no one has ever discovered a wholly new moral value, any more than a wholly new color. Well, where do these moral values come from, then? Do we create them in our changing history, like the rules of a game or like the arts? Or do we discover them? Are they posited by our wills, like the arts, or are they discovered by our mind, like the sciences? Are they subjective or objective? That is one of the biggest questions about them, and certainly the one that most radically divides our culture today. The answer every pre-modern society gave was that they were objective. The answer most philosophers, most intellectuals in modern Western society give is that they are not. Most modern intellectuals criticize the old view that there are universal, unchanging, objective, absolute moral values as narrow-minded and dogmatic. On the other side, traditionalists criticize the new view of the modern intellectuals that moral values are culturally relative and changing and man-made as immoral and destructive of morality itself as well as of society. And if they are objective, so that we discover them rather than inventing them, where do we find them? We use the word art for what we invent and nature for what we discover. So do we find moral values in nature, then, or somewhere else beyond nature? If we find them in nature, it must be in that part of nature that we call human nature. Is human nature unchanging, then? If you say no, human nature is not unchanging, and if you say that basic moral values are unchanging, then they can't come from human nature. So where do they come from? In these lectures, I will try to explain different opinions about this and other questions as fairly and clearly as I can. But I'll also tell you my own opinion for the sake of full disclosure honesty. I agree with Socrates, who was not only the first, but I think also the greatest philosopher. Socrates was confronted with that very issue of moral subjectivism versus objectivism in his society, Athens in the 5th century BC. And he agreed with the traditionalists that there were such values, but he did not believe, as most of the traditionalists in his society did, that they were secure and obvious and easy to find and to define clearly. So he offended both sides. He was neither a dogmatist nor a skeptic. That's why he asked questions. If you are a dogmatist, in the popular sense of the word, that is, if you think you have all the answers, you don't ask questions. And if you're a skeptic, if you think there is no objective truth to know, you don't ask questions either. So both the dogmatist and the skeptic do not philosophize. Neither a dogmatist nor a skeptic would be interested in listening to lectures like these. You philosophize, you think about the big questions, you buy a set of lectures like these to help you do that, only if you believe two things. First, that there are or may be some answers, some truth to be found, some valuable truth to be found. And second, you don't have it all. that it's not easy to find this truth, that it takes effort, it takes thinking. I think all real thinking takes more effort than we think. One way you know you've really been thinking and not just being entertained is that you feel exhausted after an hour or so. It takes something out of you. The adrenaline has flowed. At some point, eventually, you get very quiet. Time seems to stop. Your attention suddenly is arrested by some idea. That's what happens when you see some new truth from afar, and you see how precious it is, and how long the road to it is, and how small you are compared to that light. Another feeling you have when you really philosophize is usually confusion. You lose your way. Two opposite paths both seem to lead to the truth. Or maybe none do. If you're never confused, you're either a god or an animal, but you're not a philosopher. The best way to study ethics is by starting with the history of ethics. This is so no matter which way you answer the basic question of whether moral values are objective or subjective, natural or artificial. If moral values are not objectively real, but man-made, then the best way to study them would be by a study of history, the history of how different philosophers have made these different values. And if they are objectively real, the best way to study them is still historical, because even if they are timeless truths, like the truths of mathematics or physics, it took time for humanity to discover them and understand them, and we can appreciate them best by a study of some of the highlights of that historical process, whether it's a process of creation or of discovery, whether they're man-made or in the nature of things. By the way, when I say man-made, I am using inclusive language instead of the currently fashionable exclusive language, which calls itself inclusive. In Great Books English, the word man does not exclude females. Man, when used abstractly, means human nature, not masculine human nature as versus feminine human nature. And when used concretely, man means male and female human beings equally, not males as exclusive of females. The currently politically correct speech code claim that traditional English, which uses man in this gender-inclusive way, is really doing exactly the opposite of what it says. It's really excluding women. I must honestly confess that I find this claim simply false, in fact, in linguistic historical fact. And I don't believe that the best way to atone for past sins against women, and there were indeed many, is to commit new sins against language and history. Studying the history of ethics is like growing up and entering a serious adult conversation that's been going on for a long time. I remember once when I was about 3 or 4 years old, my parents had a lot of relatives and friends over for a late-night party, and I had to go to bed early. Of course, I only pretended to be asleep, and I snuck out of my bedroom and tried to overhear the conversation at the party. It was all grown-up conversation, and it felt confusing and fascinating at the same time. I think that is the experience of the beginning philosopher, starting to study the great books of the great philosophers. You enter the great conversation, but that takes time. You need to know some history first, and to know what these adults are talking about. What has the conversation been about so far? That's the purpose of these lectures, to translate the adult conversation of the great philosophers into language we children can understand. Because I'm a child, too. I'm not a great philosopher. I'm a teacher of philosophy, which means a translator, an interpreter of the philosophers to students, to beginners. Great philosophers don't take my classes. They write my books. This course of 14 lectures is only a sample, some highlights, not a complete summary of the history of ethics. I will suggest a few great books for you to read in connection with some of the lectures, some Socratic dialogues of Plato, The Republic, Aristotle's Ethics, Machiavelli's The Prince, Kant's Metaphysics of Morals. The lectures should lead you to the books, like a matchmaker. If you've read some of these books already, please read them again. A great book is a book that rewards endlessly repeated rereading. It's inexhaustible, like a person. Have you ever said to yourself, "Why should I talk to Sam? I've talked to him once already." Of course you don't say that, and you don't say that about Plato either. So please don't say, "I've read Plato's Republic. That's like saying, I've met Plato once. You always find something new each time, if you read both with your ears and with your tongue. That is, if you both listen and talk back. If you let Plato question you, and then you respond and question him. And if you ask the right, reasonable questions, you'll find your great book answering you, coming alive, almost like a ghost. A book is a little bit like the ghost of its author. Not as alive as the embodied person was, but nevertheless, it's alive. For minds are immortal. If you want some advice for reading great books, I highly recommend Mortimer Adler's How to Read a Book. It gives you the logic of reading, the structure and strategy of reading. It's a rather dull book to read, but if you use it, it makes all other books you read much more interesting. Just as a cookbook is dull reading, but if you use it, it makes all the meals you cook more interesting. I want to use the rest of this introductory lecture to define the subject matter of this course a little better, to tell you what I mean by ethics. I will do that by mentioning seven things I believe ethics is not, seven things that are often confused with ethics, seven things this course is not fundamentally about. All seven may be mentioned in the course, but only in relation to what ethics is most fundamentally about, which is the good life, the good person, good and evil, right and wrong. By the way, I will use the words ethics and morals or morality in the same way. Some philosophers distinguish them by using the word morality for our spontaneous, unthought moral values, and the word ethics for conscious, rational, philosophical thinking about our moral values. I think that's an artificial distinction, because as soon as you have a human being, you have conscious, rational, philosophical thinking. It's only a matter of degree how rational, how philosophical, and how self-conscious the thinking is. Many people distinguish ethics and morality by an unconscious set of connotations or associations. Morality to them connotes personal, private values, while ethics connotes public values. Morality connotes something that's expected to vary with different individuals, while ethics connotes something that the whole society is expected to agree on. And perhaps connected with this difference, morality usually connotes sexual morality above all, while ethics connotes justice above all. I think that's a misleading distinction, too, because both sex and justice are important in life, and both need to work well, and both raise ethical questions, and neither one is merely private or merely public. Sex is something you do with somebody else, if only in your fantasies, and thus it always has something to do with justice, with fairness to those others. And justice is something that, however social it is, only an individual can practice. When you call a whole society good or bad, you mean primarily that it's good or bad individuals making it good or bad, or that its laws and institutions make those individuals in it to be better or worse. I see no way of keeping any moral value in the private sector alone or in the public sector alone. Now, here are the seven common misunderstandings about ethics. First, many people think of ethics as a kind of checkup, like going to the doctor every 6 months to be sure you don't have anything to worry about, like cancer. When some new program or institution comes from government or a business or in medicine, an ethician is often called in to be sure nothing unethical is going on there. Ethics then is like a PS, like don't forget your umbrella just in case it rains. Don't forget your ethics just in case something immoral comes up. Ethics is then a kind of veto power, something negative. Check that what you're doing isn't X, Y, or Z. But ethics is really much more important and more interesting than that. It's positive. It's about the good life. It's not about not doing something so much as it is about doing something or doing it well. And it's not merely a checklist of rules. It's substantive. It's essential. It's about the good life. All of life is ethical. For instance, telling a joke is an ethical act, because it's a morally good thing to have a sense of humor. It contributes a little bit to the good life. Wicked people usually lack a good sense of humor. And humor has power, power to bypass reasoning and influence us without argument. And that power can be used for good or evil, just like any power. So there is morally good and morally bad humor. jokes can hurt or heal. They can weaken our foolish attachment to some demagogue by on-target satire, or they can weaken our attachment to someone who's wise and good by unfair satire. The reason many people think of ethics as a kind of PS or checkup is, I think, because they think of it as a set of abstract rules. Most great ethical philosophers think of it as an investigation into something real and solid and substantial. What is a good person and what is a good life? Those are much more fundamental questions. A second confusion is between morals and mores. Mores are facts, morals are values. Mores are patterns of behavior, morals are principles of behavior. Mores are common to man and beast. Morals are present in man alone. I say beast instead of animals because we are animals too, rational animals. By beast, I mean animals without human reason. The difference between morals and mores corresponds to the difference between shame and guilt. Shame is the frustration of the desire to be accepted by others, by the group, the desire to save face. Guilt is the frustration of the desire to be morally good. Shame is social. Guilt is individual. Shame comes from others. Guilt comes from yourself. When the dog pees on the carpet, it feels no guilt. It feels shame only if you see it. When your pants fall down in public, you feel shame, but not when it happens in private. But you don't feel guilt for something you didn't freely choose. In guilt, the self is divided into two in a way no animal can do. One of the two is the observing and judging self that says you are guilty or you are not guilty, you are evil or you are good. The other self is the observed, judged self that hears this judgment. So it is this self-consciousness, this ability to split ourselves into two, the subject and the object of judgment, that distinguishes us from the beasts. It is not consciousness, but self-consciousness that distinguishes us. All animals have consciousness, and many of them are superior to us in their consciousness of the world. They often have better senses than we do. But only man has self-consciousness. That's why only man has ethics. There seem to be at least three distinctly human powers innate to human nature that animals don't have. One of them is the power of free choice, the power to make moral judgments. That's the subject of ethics. Our ethical awareness is usually called conscience. It's not just practical judgment about what works, but moral judgment about what's right. It's not just, if we don't hit each other on the head, we won't hurt so bad. Animals might be able to figure that out too, but it's wrong to hit you on the head. A second distinctively human power is religion, the ability to believe in and worship some absolute, something like God. Again, not for practical purposes, but for its own sake. And a third is the aesthetic sense, the love of beauty for beauty's sake, not for practical purposes, like sexual attraction. Animals don't seem to appreciate aesthetic or religious or moral values. A fourth distinctively human power is often said to be curiosity or the thirst for truth for its own sake rather than for practical success, like the sniffing dog's curiosity about where its food is. But some of the higher animals seem to have curiosity too, so I'm not sure that that does distinguish us. But we obviously have a power the beasts don't have in this area, the mind. We can abstract. We can know universal truths like two and two are always four, and effects always need causes, and all men are mortal. That's why our language is so different from all animal languages. It has not only words for concrete things, but also for abstractions like these. A third popular confusion is between ethics and psychology. Ethics is not about how you feel about yourself or about certain actions. Animals have feelings too, though not as subtle and complex as ours. Psychology studies our feelings, including our feelings about good and evil, that is, guilt feelings. But guilt feelings are not guilt. A cartoon has a prisoner looking up at the judge and protesting, "But, Judge, I don't feel guilty." Psychology may try to take away our guilt feelings, but to take away our guilt, we need something else, something like religion, something like the mercy of Allah or the Day of Atonement or the blood of Christ. There's a lot of confusion in our society between psychology and philosophy, and therefore between psychology and ethics, which is part of philosophy. My philosophy students constantly begin sentences in philosophy essays with the words, "I feel that." That's psychology, not philosophy. It's also bad grammar. You don't feel that, you just feel. You think or believe that A is B. That's a truth claim. There's no truth claim in feelings, and therefore no argument. When someone says, "I feel sick," you don't reply, "No, I feel great." I hate yogurt and you love it, and those are just two facts about how we feel, but not a truth claim and not an argument. Philosophy is not the same as religion either. Philosophy doesn't claim to remove guilt, but philosophy can argue about it. Religion claims to remove guilt, but religion doesn't argue. We'll talk more about the difference between ethics and religion in a few minutes. A fourth confusion: ethics is not ideology, whether left or right. An ideology is man-made. Ethics seeks the real truth about good and evil that does not change with time and place, as ideology does. Ideologies can be judged as moral or immoral. There can be ethical as well as political arguments between ideologies such as right and left. For instance, is it more ethical to give welfare to the poor out of compassion and the golden rule, or is it more ethical not to teach them to fish rather than give them a fish? Ethics argues about and judges ideology. Some ethical philosophers today, notably the deconstructionists, disagree with this. They say that ethics is just ideology, in fact, camouflaged ideology, power putting on the mask of justice. In other words, might makes right. Machiavelli teaches this, but it's a claim as old as the Greek sophists, and we will explore it when we study Socrates and Plato. A fifth confusion is between ethics and what philosophers call meta-ethics. Ethics is thinking about good and evil. Meta-ethics is thinking about ethics. Much of contemporary philosophical ethics is meta-ethics. It asks questions like how moral statements are linguistically meaningful, or how moral reasoning differs from reasoning about facts. For instance, whether the conclusion of any moral argument can be certain, whether any value judgment can be infallible, and how we make these moral judgments. Those are important questions, and we'll touch on some of them, but they're secondary. They're secondary in time. They come later. In fact, they come in the third place, after we've first made moral choices, after morality has first appeared in our experience, and then, in the second place, we've reflected on this moral experience and moral values philosophically. Only then do we, in the third place, make a reflection on our ethical reflections. It's like making a movie about life. These questions are also secondary in interest. Ordinary people rarely ask them, only philosophers do. But ordinary people are very interested in first-order ethical questions. Confusion number six is between ethics and applied ethics, which we've spoken of before, casuistry. Applied ethics is to ethics as technology is to theoretical science. There are many new tricky situations that call for the application of ethical principles in medicine, business, law, social science, life sciences. But for this, you need to know the specific details of the field. Knowledge of philosophical principles is not enough. For instance, I've never taught business ethics or legal ethics or medical ethics because I just don't know enough about business or law or medicine. And the seventh confusion may be between ethics and religion. You don't need religious faith to do ethics, though it may help you to do it. Philosophy and religion may be synthesizable, marriable, but they're as different as male and female. Ethics is based on reason, religion is based on faith, or on fear. But religious fear is very different from practical fear. The fear of God or of a spirit is very different than the fear of a tiger or a cancer or a bullet. It's something in another dimension, something unknown, something awesome. The religious instinct is to believe in or aspire to or worship that transcendent, mysterious something. The moral instinct is to feel obligated in conscience to do good and avoid evil. Both instincts are in another dimension from the practical. I know I stand a better practical chance of surviving if I don't jump in the lake and try to save the drowning baby, but I may jump in anyway because I feel morally obligated to do it. So both religion and morality go beyond the practical and the factual. So we might confuse these two things with each other, especially in the West, since in the three major Western religions, that which is worshipped is also supremely moral. God is righteous and commands us to be righteous. But the religious instinct and the moral instinct can be found separated from each other, more in Eastern religions than in Western, where morality does not go all the way up to ultimate reality, to a God who is a person with a moral will, and religion and morality are separated much more in pagan religions, which are often not just amoral, but sometimes immoral. And, of course, also in atheistic secularism or secularist humanism, which rejects religion but not morality. Atheists have ethics, too. One of the questions of a later lecture will be about that, the foundations of ethics without God. So, ethics is not about these seven things. A checkup, mores, psychology, ideology, applied ethics, or religion, or meta-ethics. What is it, then? It's about the good life and the good person. But that sounds very vague. We need some order, some outline, some structure. One way of doing this, logically, is to say that ethics is about three terms: good, right, and ought. Good means the thing desired, the goal, the ideal, the desired fulfillment or perfection or end. Right means the opposite of wrong, as defined by some law. And ought means personal obligation, duty, responsibility. That's what we experience in conscience. Perhaps the simplest and most helpful outline of the subject is to divide ethics into three main questions. C.S. Lewis gives us the helpful image of a fleet of ships. We are those ships, and ethics is like our sailing orders. And the sailing orders tell the ships three things. The first thing is how to cooperate, how to avoid bumping into each other, how to supply each other's needs. That's social ethics. The second thing is how each ship is to stay shipshape and afloat. That's individual ethics, virtue ethics, how to be a good person, character, moral character. If you don't have good individuals, you can't make a good society. Just as if you don't have good bricks, you can't build a good building. And the third thing the ships have to know is the most important of all. What is their mission? Why are they at sea in the first place? That corresponds to the question of values, especially the highest value, the greatest good, the meaning of life, the ultimate purpose and goal of human life. If we don't know or care where we're going, then it doesn't make much of a difference which roads we choose. In Alice in Wonderland, there's this philosophical conversation between Alice and the Cheshire Cat. "Would you please tell me which way I ought to go from here?" said Alice. "That depends on where you want to get to," said the cat. "I don't much care where," said Alice. "Then it doesn't matter which way you go." So this, I think, is the most important question of all. At least according to the ancient philosophers, quo vadis, where are you going? What is the goal? Many modern philosophers ignore that question, either because they're afraid it's too religious, and they're afraid that arguing about religion will put us back into the times of religious wars, or else they ignore that question because they're too skeptical to think we can ever answer it. Most modern philosophers make a very sharp distinction between questions about what is and questions about what ought to be, between facts and values, so that values are not facts and therefore not knowable as true or false. Ancient philosophers do not make that sharp distinction. They think that values are the most important facts of all, that the good is part of reality, that what ought to be is a part of or a dimension of what is. Their worldview, their metaphysics, included a life view or an ethics. One of the recurring themes of this course will be that everyone's ethics depends on his metaphysics, or lack of it. Ethics must depend on metaphysics because what is the good for man depends on what is. And ethics must also depend on your anthropology, on your philosophy of human nature, because what is the good for man depends on what man is. And ethics must also depend on epistemology, which is that division of philosophy that studies knowing, because knowing what the good for man is depends on what knowing is. So we will be asking questions of metaphysics and anthropology and epistemology, as well as questions of ethics. You can no more separate them than you can separate the stories of a single building. We can distinguish them in thought, and we should, but we can't separate them and treat them as if they were separate and independent buildings. We can abstract out these different questions, but we should be careful to avoid the philosopher's favorite fallacy, the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, treating abstractions as if they were concrete realities. We are the concrete realities. The contrast I've drawn between ancient and modern attitudes to ethics needs to be made much more clear and specific, because it will be a theme running through the whole course. That will be the subject of our next lecture. To prepare for it, you might try to outguess me and construct the lecture yourself before you listen to it. Write down the outline of the lecture you would give if you had to compare the traditional ethics with the typically modern ethics, point by point.
This ends Lecture 1.